We are dealing at this symposium with the problems of deterring humanitarian law violations, specifically how to strengthen enforcement. In this panel, our concern is examples of non-compliance using case studies. My assignment within this is the Vietnam War. And if there ever was an exemplary case study in non-compliance, it was the Vietnam War. My remarks are divided into two parts. First, I would like to examine the question of how great was the deviation from humanitarian law. In effect, put the war on trial to fix the degree of guilt, chiefly as compared to other wars. This is best approached through the device of competing perceptions, how individuals, whole societies, viewed the war and the individual acts of war. Second, I would like to say a bit about the nature of the nature and meaning. It is my thesis that the Vietnam War was different in kind, not just in degree, but in kind, from all wars that preceded it. And that being true, it is necessary to judge the war and judge humanitarian law violations with differing criteria than employed in earlier wars. Vietnam War produced an astounding range of interpretation and explanations. Most of it was permeated, is permeated, by stereotypes, factual error, social myth, gross oversimplification, historical fiction, sheer hyperbolic exaggeration, and not a small amount of old-fashioned BS. This was because the passion the war generated, it also reflected modern-day debasement of language. Interpretive materials have a second characteristic. The various aspects of the war, the respective phenomena, if you will, were and are held in vastly differing perspectives. Sifting through the billions of words and pictures emerging from the period, one is struck by the repetitive, almost systematic, dualism of opposing viewpoints. It might be called the mirror image syndrome. Perception of the war as a whole, or in most of its detail, varied between the two sides and within each side. North Vietnamese had one perception, South Vietnamese another, as did the Viet Cong, the Americans, the Chinese, the Thais, the Australians, the Koreans, and the onlookers. Hardly any two persons saw the war in identical terms. Hardly any two could agree on fundamental definitions of the nature of the war, what it was all about. These competing perceptions range across the entire spectrum of the history. On the nature of the war, was it new in kind or simply another war? On purposes, moral purpose or national interest, ideological purpose or realpolitik, on the meaning and the consequences of the war. Now all these are abstract perceptions. Then there is the finite level of perceptions, competing perceptions. The magnitude of the war, the course of the battle, are we winning or losing, the nature of South Vietnam, of the nature of the communist side, possibilities of a negotiated settlement, the press in the war, anti-war movement, legality of the war, war and the law, and our concern here, war in humanity. Vietnam War, then, was a prison of competing perceptions. That fact is the main heritage for us today, this general lack of historical agreement. Now, to put the war on trial, how guilty was it in terms of inhumanity? As with all else in the war, there is this range of perceptions. There is the unspeakable horror perception, it on one hand, it holds that the Vietnam War was the most horrible, brutal, atrocity-ridden war in recent history. It was primitive savagery augmented by modern technology. War criminality by the Americans and the South Vietnamese was commonplace. My Lai was not the rule, not the exception, nor were the communists without blame. Witness the Way massacre, or the systematic assassination of village leaders, which amounted to genocide. Suffering was universal and inflicted on far more innocents than in previous wars. That was one cluster of perception. Standing against this is the perception that war is war. This thesis argues that while a humane war is a contradiction of terms, even an oxymoron, the Vietnam War certainly, as far as the Americans were concerned, was more carefully conducted than any earlier war. Rules of engagement and other restrictions on military actions were enforced for the first time, really, in any war. Atrocities were less common, they were only better known. Communists, for their part, were not deliberately bloody-handed. Much of their brutality stemmed from the kind of war they conducted, a people's war, in which people are both chief target and primary weapon. The Americans would have preferred war out and away from the population centers, in outer space even. But the communists forced a war over and around the people. This was the war nightly viewed on American television, which thus left the impression that it was more brutal than other wars. Thus, the first point I would like to leave you with is that there is, and there will continue to remain, a condition of competing perceptions on how much non-compliance in terms of general public opinion, on how much non-compliance. In terms of general public opinion, that is to say in non-legal terms, we cannot go much beyond this struggle of competing perception, at least not yet. It is, for the average person, a matter of personal philosophy, involving both political thinking and moral values. So I can only say to them, asking the question how moral was the Vietnam War, how much immorality was there in the war, say, as they say on the Monday night football commercials, you make the call. But not for international lawyers or for the law itself, which I assume is the basic purpose of this gathering, to ask what can be done. Answer, of course, is we must codify errant behavior, then find a way to enforce compliance. As you know better than I, there have been systematic efforts in this direction, beginning in a serious way after World War I. On outlawing weapons such as poison gas, on treatment of prisoners of war, world court, and so on. None of this suffices now, I argue. We've gone beyond these relatively elementary standards, and that brings me to my second point. Vietnam War, properly viewed, should be seen as a culmination of a developmental process. For about 200 years, it has been an unbroken chain of development, socio-political and technological. Two major characteristics of this process. First, the definition of warfare grew steadily broader, from narrow and specific to vast and amorphous, during which the line between war and non-war grew ever more blurred. Second, this developmental process has been characterized by the advent of steadily refined military technology. Great watershed in this process was the era of Napoleon Bonaparte. He is generally credited with, or blamed for, the invention of modern-day concept of nationalism and its application to warfare. That is the idea of a conscript army fighting for a geographically bounded area called the nation-state. Before Napoleon, warfare was in the hands of the professional soldier, the mercenary, who fought for his liege lord, and for his liege lord's purpose, be it territory or revenge or a buried god's tomb. In those days, the term mercenary was a respectable one. It was a profession, performed for money, under firm, self-imposed rules on behavior, rules of behavior. Combat was the mercenary's occupation. Material were his rewards. Since the professional mercenary's entire career was given over to warfare, he looked on prospective battle with caution, coolly calculating the odds. He could truly believe that he who fights to run away, lives to fight another day, was not a coward's rationalization, but simple sanity. Napoleon fielded the first true nation-state army, cemented together not by loot or blood or heaven's reward, but by an abstraction of geography, fought by men who could afford high-risk, unconditional surrender of war, since they would soon return to the less dangerous civilian pursuits. Napoleon took the war out of the hands of the cautious professional soldier and put it into the hands of the rash and unrestrained civilian. And it's still there. Invention of the citizen soldier blurred the line between military and civilian, but simply between military and civilian in uniform, but civilian as participant and non-participant. In the process, almost incidentally, warfare became broader and broader, and then unlimited. By World War II, with the advent of saturation bombing, civilians had become legitimate targets and major participants. There was rhetoric on both sides during World War II that deplored the killing of civilians and spoke of military versus non-military bombing targets. But the fact, with mass weapons of this type, any effort to separate warfare from bystander was meaningless. You're bombing them through 5 miles. You're 5 miles up, and you're bombing through cloud cover. And that's as meaningless. Meaningless. 5 miles up, and you're bombing them through cloud cover. In the Vietnam War, the Vietnamese communists, borrowing it from the Chinese, erased entirely the line between military and civilian by ruling out the notion of non-combatant. Kind of war they developed precluded, by definition, the disinterested bystander. Not even children were excluded. Particularly not even children, one might say. People, all people, including children, became weapons of war and therefore were expendable as any weapon is expendable in war. This is the new face of war we have seen develop since the Vietnam War, carry on from the Vietnam War. Seen it in the past decade in the Mideast, Africa, Latin America, in what was Yugoslavia, and in New York's World Trade Center and London department stores. André Malraux in The Conquerors wrote the foreshadowing of this. During the commune, a fellow was arrested. He cried, "But I never dabbled in politics." Precisely, and his head was broken. Allow me to conclude with a few thoughts on the social context of what you are trying to do. That is to deter violation of humanitarian law by strengthening the enforcement mechanism. You must always bear in mind, you must always act in accordance with the great philosophic enigma, the condition that we call warfare. If you don't, what you attempt will become meaningless. Through this century, that has been the chief reason we have failed in the efforts to deal with humanitarian law violation. We have not addressed the nature of the beast. Attitudes toward war appear cyclical, recur cyclically in every century. After a war, survivors deplore its folly, seek to find compensating benefits for its devastation. The result for them becomes a vast paradox. They looked steadily and searchingly on the face of the war just past, on the suffering and on the celebration of the martial spirit, seeing both good and bad, a mixture of glory and carnage. Looking back through the centuries at war, they see it as an inevitable thing, an ever-present fact, as inescapable as tragedy, as eradicable as death. Wars have, they conclude, a common pattern. It is all the same, whether with sword on the plains of Troy, with musket on the frozen Russian steppes, with M16 in the jungles of Vietnam. War looses a fury that drives human nature to the extremes of nobility and debasement, to great swings of action that range from heroic strength to cringing weakness. War is a spectacle of agony, a domain pervaded by darkness and dismay, by torn bodies and ruined minds, amid which, there on the battlefield, are lightning-like flashes of courage and brotherhood, even compassion. A paradox. Even compassion. A paradox. Beyond all else, war is the realm of force and chance. It is power and it is probability, or luck, or joss. Our perceptions of war vary. There are three major ones. First, war is glory and holy. War is glory and wholly satisfying. Homer, Shakespeare, old Norse skaldic poetry filled with hymns to battle, to killing sprees. War is the supreme challenge, the drama of life extended to its maximum. It is risk and adventure, danger and release, travel and comradeship. It serves civilization, freedom, and all the higher virtues. Second perception of war. First perception of war. Second perception of war. War is a mysterious sin, but a sometimes occasional necessity, a messy shaking out of Hegel. Kant, Hegel, Lincoln. Third perception, basic perception, war is history made mad. It's a picnic of cannibals, a takeover by the reptilian brain, the oaf's answer to the problems that challenge. Buddha, Freud, Christ. Hegel was perhaps the most profound philosopher of war. He regarded it as social therapy, a means of keeping the state from growing corrupt, society from stagnating. War, he said, preserved the ethical health of the people, like the blowing of wind preserves the sea from foulness, which would be the result of a prolonged calm. He equated the idea of perpetual peace with prolonged corruption. The war of which he spoke, the mental image he carried, was vastly different from today. Hegel was born in 1770, before the technological revolution in warfare, which rendered some forms of war, nuclear war for instance, absurd. Hegel remains valid for his contention of the criterion of war. He held that the test of war, its only true test, was necessity. Is this war, or that war, or whatever war, necessary? That's an unambiguous rule, but it's one difficult to apply, except, of course, in retrospect, as we do with Vietnam. But to command humanitarian behavior in war, to command humanitarian behavior in war, we can agree. So that is the challenge. It requires addressing the tyranny of national sovereignty. There are, I believe, 173 sovereign entities on this planet. The one thing they all agree on is that they have a right to kick their own. How to rein in this sovereign tyranny? For international justice, we need international courts, a body of doctrine, text, precedent. We also need an enforcement mechanism, an international sheriff. Aye, there's the rub. Whence comes the sheriff? As the line has it, from the old Irish poem has it, if I'm a gentleman and you are a lady, who is to put the pig out of the parlor?
Chà, chà.
Tomatoes.
Cà chua, cà chua.
Turnips.
Su hào, su hào.
Vegetables.
Rau đậu, rau đậu.
Where is the theater?
Thưa ông, rạp hát ở đâu? Thưa ông, rạp hát ở đâu?
This is a good seat.
Chỗ này tốt lắm. Chỗ này tốt lắm.
Did you buy the ticket at the box office?
Ông mua vé ở chỗ bán vé phải không? Ông mua vé ở chỗ bán vé phải không?
What play is scheduled for next week?
Tuần sau hát tuồng gì? Tuần sau hát tuồng gì?
Please reserve two tickets for Friday.
Ông làm ơn giữ cho tôi hai vé tối thứ sáu. Ông làm ơn giữ cho tôi hai vé tối thứ sáu.
At what time does the play begin?
Mấy giờ bắt đầu hát? Mấy giờ bắt đầu hát?
Is it a comedy?
Có phải là một vở hài kịch không? Có phải là một vở hài kịch không?
Is it a tragedy?
Có phải là một vở bi kịch không? Có phải là một vở bi kịch không?
Where is the baseball park?
Thưa ông, sân giã cầu ở đâu? Thưa ông, sân giã cầu ở đâu?
Where is the hotel?
Thưa ông, khách sạn ở đâu? Thưa ông, khách sạn ở đâu?
What is the rate per day?
Tiền buồng mỗi ngày là bao nhiêu? Tiền buồng mỗi ngày là bao nhiêu?
Week.
Tuần. Tuần.
Month.
Tháng. Tháng.
Have you a room with a bath or shower?
Ông có buồng có thùng tắm hay douche không? Ông có buồng có thùng tắm hay douche không?
Have you an air-conditioned room?
Ông có buồng có máy lạnh không? Ông có buồng có máy lạnh không?
I want a better room.
Tôi muốn một cái buồng tốt hơn. Tôi muốn một cái buồng tốt hơn.
Cheaper.
Rẻ hơn. Rẻ hơn.
Larger.
Rộng hơn. Rộng hơn.
Quiet.
Yên tĩnh. Yên tĩnh.
Smaller.
Nhỏ hơn. Nhỏ hơn.
Your name, please.
Xin ông cho biết tên. Xin ông cho biết tên.
Your age.
Ông bao nhiêu tuổi? Ông bao nhiêu tuổi?
Occupation.
Ông làm nghề gì? Ông làm nghề gì?
Destination.
Ông sẽ đi đâu? Ông sẽ đi đâu?
I am sleepy.
Tôi buồn ngủ. Tôi buồn ngủ.
I want bedding.
Tôi muốn có chăn màn. Tôi muốn có chăn màn.
Hot water.
Nước nóng. Nước nóng.
Ice.
Nước đá. Nước đá.
A light.
Một cái đèn. Một cái đèn.
I want a pillow.
Ông làm ơn cho tôi một cái gối. Ông làm ơn cho tôi một cái gối.
Soap.
Xà bông. Xà bông.
Toilet paper.
Giấy vệ sinh. Giấy vệ sinh.
A bath towel.
Một cái khăn tắm. Một cái khăn tắm.
Another blanket.
Một cái mền nữa. Một cái mền nữa.
Please wake me up at 6 a.m.
Ông làm ơn đánh thức tôi dậy 6 giờ sáng. Ông làm ơn đánh thức tôi dậy 6 giờ sáng.
Where is the bathroom?
Phòng tắm ở đâu? Phòng tắm ở đâu?
Barber shop.
Tiệm hớt tóc. Tiệm hớt tóc.
Hairdresser.
Tiệm uốn tóc. Tiệm uốn tóc.
Please have these clothes washed.
Ông làm ơn bỏ giặt những quần áo này. Ông làm ơn bỏ giặt những quần áo này.
When can I have them back?
Bao giờ thì giặt xong? Bao giờ thì giặt xong?
I want a key to my room.
Ông cho tôi một cái chìa khóa buồng. Ông cho tôi một cái chìa khóa buồng.
I'm going away tomorrow.
Ngày mai thì tôi rời khách sạn. Ngày mai thì tôi rời khách sạn.
I want to speak to the manager.
Tôi muốn gặp ông quản lý khách sạn. Tôi muốn gặp ông quản lý khách sạn.
Here is my new address.
Đây là địa chỉ mới của tôi. Đây là địa chỉ mới của tôi.
Please forward my mail.
Ông làm ơn cho gửi theo thư từ của tôi. Ông làm ơn cho gửi theo thư từ của tôi.
I shall return tomorrow.
Ngày mai tôi sẽ trở lại. Ngày mai tôi sẽ trở lại.
Give me my bill, please.
Ông làm ơn cho tôi biết tôi thiếu bao nhiêu tiền. Ông làm ơn cho tôi biết tôi thiếu bao nhiêu tiền.
Please call a taxi.
Ông làm ơn kêu dùm tôi một cái taxi. Ông làm ơn kêu dùm tôi một cái taxi.
Please show me a good restaurant.
Ông chỉ dùm tôi một tiệm ăn ngon. Ông chỉ dùm tôi một tiệm ăn ngon.
We desire breakfast.
Chúng tôi muốn ăn sáng. Chúng tôi muốn ăn sáng.
Lunch.
Ăn trưa. Ăn trưa.
Dinner.
Ăn tối. Ăn tối.
May I see the menu?
Ông làm ơn cho tôi xem thực đơn. Ông làm ơn cho tôi xem thực đơn.
Please bring me a cup.
Ông mang cho tôi một cái chén. Ông mang cho tôi một cái chén.
A fork.
Một cái nĩa. Một cái nĩa.
A glass.
Một cái ly. Một cái ly.
A knife.
Một con dao. Một con dao.
A plate.
Một cái đĩa bàn. Một cái đĩa bàn.
A spoon.
Một cái muỗng. Một cái muỗng.
Tea.
Trà. Trà.
Pepper.
Tiêu. Tiêu.
Salt.
Muối. Muối.
Sugar.
Đường. Đường.
Vinegar.
Giấm. Giấm.
Bread and butter.
Bánh mì và bơ. Bánh mì và bơ.
Please bring me the bill.
Ông làm ơn tính tiền dùm. Ông làm ơn tính tiền dùm.
QEDFM in San Francisco. Tomorrow evening at 10:30, we'll bring you a rebroadcast of a town hall meeting held this past Wednesday The topic is Jewish and Arab discrimination. Guests include Rabbi Alan Bennett, Regional Executive Director of the American Jewish Conference, and Emily Shihad, a Palestinian-American actress. KQED's Kevin Persklove is the moderator. That's Jewish and Arab discrimination on a town hall meeting tomorrow night at 10:30 here on KQED Radio.
Welcome back to the Carousel Ballroom at the Guest Quarters Suite Hotel in Santa Monica, where our KCRW LA Theater Works broadcast continues with the media symposium, The Press Goes to War, Vietnam and the Persian Gulf. I'd like to introduce Bob Maynard, editor and publisher of the Oakland Tribune, who was a member of the Washington Post editorial board at the time of the Pentagon Papers. Mr. Maynard will serve as the moderator of our distinguished panel of journalists.
Thank you, Richard Dysart. I'm pleased to be here tonight as we tackle the issue of the news media, war, and national security. Joining us by telephone from the studios of National Public Radio in Washington, D.C., are Ben Bradley, executive editor of the Washington Post, then and now. He was portrayed in our docudrama earlier this evening by Edward Asner, and Carla Robbins, senior editor of U.S. News and World Report, who has just returned from the front, where she served as a pool reporter covering the Persian Gulf War. On stage with me here in the ballroom are Peter Braestrup, noted journalist and author of Battle Lines, The Military and the Media, and Robert Scheer, national correspondent for the Los Angeles Times, and George Wilson, veteran Washington Post military correspondent who, if you happen to tune in late and didn't hear the dramatic denouement of our docudrama, is the man whose photographic memory helped win the day in court for the Washington Post in the Pentagon Papers case. We begin with a question to Ben Bradley and to Mr. Wilson. You have just heard yourselves portrayed from another war and another time. Tell us what you think we in the media and the nation have learned between that war and this about the relationship between the news media and the military. Mr. Bradley?
Well, I don't, the government has learned a hell of a lot. I think they've learned that government, is scared of the truth and would rather the truth not come out.
Mr. Wilson.
Well, I think the Vietnam War was the war where the press came of age as auditors as opposed to cheerleaders, which was the case in most instances in World War II. I think that the recent Persian Gulf War is when the Pentagon came of age as news managers. The facts were bad in Vietnam, and so it was very tempting to shoot the messenger of those facts, namely the press. The facts are good in the Persian Gulf, and it's rightly so that the military gets praised, but I'm not so sure that they had to exercise such tight control and limit the explanations of what was going on there.
Mr. Scheer?
Well, first of all, I don't agree the facts are good. I don't think it's good to have 100,000 people dead. And it's become a non-story. I think you're right about managing the news. Vietnam, the bombing caused a lot of unhappiness and criticism, raised a lot of questions. And now the Defense Department and the government has figured out how to keep people away from the effect of bombing. So the people who died in that war, be they civilian or or not, are forgotten. They're the forgotten people of this war. And I would like to say one thing about the tapeworm thing. I think there is a tapeworm that has to be fed, but it's fed 98% of the time by government handouts. And the president said today, and the secretary of state said today, and so forth, and only 2% represents contrarian or independent journalism. And I think we ought not to be lulled by this play into a sort of celebratory mood about the media.
Okay, I won't worry about you. I won't worry you about your math as to what happened to the other 8%. Mr. Braestrup.
Well, I said 98 and 2, I'm sorry.
Well, Norman Mailer used to talk about feeding the goat. The goat has to be fed every day. And one reason everybody was so unhappy in Saudi Arabia, and I would have been unhappy as a Washington Post correspondent, which I was in Vietnam, I had been very unhappy in Saudi Arabia because there was no story of the conventional type until the ground war began. That story lasted 100 hours. It was well reported, I thought, given the circumstances. But I would also argue that in contrast to Vietnam, we did have an idea of what was happening in the enemy capital. We happened to have, for the first time in our history, reporters in the enemy capital reporting on what they could see within very tight constraints. Peter Arnett of CNN, another Vietnam hand, was there, and from time to time others were. And I think in contrast to the Vietnam story, we did understand that Iraqi civilians were being killed by the air war. We also were able to understand inadvertently that we were not carpet bombing Baghdad, just as we never carpet bombed Hanoi.
Well, let's turn to the question of how the relationship worked out in reality. Mr. Bradley, there have been published reports, I'm sure you've seen them, that the Post and several other news organizations had advanced knowledge of General Schwarzkopf's Hail Mary maneuver, that you knew it in advance and that you decided not to publish the story until after the campaign had been completed. Is that true?
No, that isn't true, Bob. We had advanced knowledge of so many things. The only problem is we didn't know whether they were true or not. I mean, we had advanced knowledge that they were going to start on February 3rd. We had advanced knowledge they were going to start this. They had advanced knowledge that there was going to be an amphibious landing. We had an advanced... We had advanced knowledge of everything. But we also had the feeling that a lot of this advanced knowledge was just armchair quarterbacking by somebody. So... Oh, I mean, we—you know us better than that. If we just wouldn't have—if we had known it, we would have probably printed it.
So much.
See, look, I mean, I think plainly too, as Schwarzkopf admitted, he wanted us to print a whole lot of things. He sure as hell wanted us to print the.
Well, he wanted you to print Imminent Thunder, but I'm not quite sure he wanted you to print Hail Mary.
Well, you know, probably he didn't. But I didn't know about it, so that's...
All right. But the question...
You wouldn't have printed it, Ben.
The question that lurks...
Not if you'd been there, Peter.
Did you hear what Peter said? He said you wouldn't have printed it. The question that lurks behind the report, obviously, and I'd like all of our panelists to address this question, is the degree to which... In this war, the press could fairly be described as having been, in some degree, in partners with the Pentagon. And that if an American news organization was persuaded by the Pentagon that a given story might jeopardize American lives or other aspects of the operation, that the material would be withheld for that purpose. Now, are you suggesting that hell-bent for leather and no holes barred, if you knew that a campaign of this sort was about to get underway and that, in essence, Schwarzkopf had managed to fool the enemy and had him facing east toward the Gulf while he went around the backside, that you would have said, in essence, this is what's really going to happen?
Oh, no, of course not. But, I mean, that happens. It doesn't have to be... Desert storm. I mean, if we are convinced that we are in possession of information that is genuinely damaging to the national security of the United States, we won't publish it. The trouble is they claim it all the time, and it so seldom is true.
Ms. Robbins, would you say to tell us to what degree you felt pressure from the military in the field to be a partner as opposed to being a reporter?
Well, I mean, there is always that situation, and it doesn't matter if you're in the field or if you're in Washington, D.C. I mean, we're all American citizens, and there's also a natural cooperation that tries to go on. It's a very symbiotic relationship that goes on between the press and its sources and between the government and the press. They're always trying to use us, and we're always trying to let them think that they're going to use us so we can get as much information as we can to publish it. Of course, in a war, it's a somewhat more extreme case. And I don't think that my editors, luckily I don't have to make these decisions, I don't think my editors would publish anything that would jeopardize American lives. I think that would be a crazy thing to do. And as a reporter in the field, I certainly would give the coordinates of any unit that I was with to call down a strike. Of course, I constantly was explaining that to the U.S. military, that beyond an issue of patriotism, my own survival was at stake, and they should lighten up a little bit with us. There is a larger issue here, and that we, I think, really need to address, which is participating in the pools itself. Is that an issue of collaboration? I mean, I was a pool coordinator for quite a long time in this, and not just because I'm a Girl Scout, but also because that was the system that was worked out by our bureau chiefs in the wake of Panama and Grenada, where the military tried its best and succeeded in keeping any reporters from the news. This time, they made a pact with the devil, and the pact didn't work great. And the thing that I'm really, really worried about is that we're not going to examine it afterwards. The war went so quickly, and the American public is so enthusiastic about what happened, that when we in the press raised the question next time around, saying that we didn't have enough access to carry out the story, I'm afraid that the public is going to shout us down. Did we collaborate?
Will.
We tried to work with them. Did the system work? Hell no. And I think it's time that we have to re-examine it. I'm not suggesting that we all go unilateral or, you know, try to run outside the military at all times. We've got to work with them at times. But at the same time, the system didn't work, and it really needs to be examined closely.
Well, I'd like to get our panel here in Los Angeles into this. George, would you begin by telling us what you feel the press and therefore the public lost as a result of whatever restrictions were imposed on reporters in the field?
Well, news abhors a vacuum. And I think if you look back at what appeared in the newspapers, about 80% of it came from official briefings, because the reporters who were over there were very often locked up in hotel rooms and weren't allowed out. We had 540,000 men on the ground. We had probably 30 ships standing off. And they could have had reporters out in the field, stay overnight with troops. There were no military secrets to be broadcast. But instead, it was lockstep escorts. Unlike Vietnam, you couldn't join a rifle company and stay with them for several nights, which is the way I got the best feel for what was going on in Vietnam. And the only exception to this that I could see from my vantage point in Washington was the Marine Corps was brave enough to let people go with them night after night, and I think that's why the Marines, frankly, dominated the combat news. So I think it was overkill and control, and I think we lost a great opportunity, because Peter Braestrup and I were two of the endangered species in the city room. We'd both worn the uniform of the military, and that's nothing to do with us. It's just a matter that there's been so many years of peace that there's a great suspicion between civilians and military, and I think there was a great opportunity to have reporters go out in these ships and in the various battalions and distribute this talent rather than keep it locked up.
Yeah, it was kind of yuppies in the desert there for a while. How do you feel, they used to ask. How do you feel, soldier? Not what do you know.
Bob Scherer, you weren't there, but you read a lot of the coverage. What was your feeling about what we lost by the way in which the war was covered?
By the way, I was in Vietnam three occasions, and both North and South, and my feeling was that I could often learn much more in the library when I got home. And I feel there's been altogether too much attention paid to these battle stories, the war stories that everyone likes so much. For instance, tonight on NPR, I heard a description of the liberation of Kuwait combined in a sentence with a description of the extension of martial law. And this whole thing of being a partner, the we heard very little reporting about who are these Kuwaitis. I heard very little about the 400,000 Palestinians who live in Kuwait, most of whom were born there, who are now being harassed. I heard very little about the non-Kuwaitis. I heard very little about the distinction between Kuwaitis who are connected with the royal family and those who are not, the ones who are not letting them back in. So I would say in general, in terms of whether it was the region, the whole question of oil, we picked up this incredible power in this area, very little serious reporting about that as a motivation. And I would say, basically, I'm very skeptical of what you can learn in the moment anyway. What the Pentagon Papers shows is that we knew very little about Vietnam. You had the news magazines had vivid accounts of the Battle of the Second Gulf of Tonkin, which never occurred. And we didn't learn about it authoritatively until 20 years later. You know, Noriega turned out to have been a CIA man, had $350,000. We only learned that during the Iraq thing. Maybe Saddam Hussein will turn out to have been on the CIA payroll.